See, in terms of Islamophobia in India, first we need to understand the underpinning politics in which it starts off. So we need to sort of understand, slightly understand the history of the creation of India and Pakistan, as in South Asia itself, you know. So when the British left India, you sort of have, you need to also understand the Supreme Court, which was a federal court at that point of time. The Supreme Court was perhaps the only institution which was not split into two. Okay? So the Supreme Court continues, the federal court becomes the Supreme Court, and they have one Muslim judge on the Supreme Court, and that continues through the history of the Supreme Court till Hidayatullah becomes a judge. Okay? This apart, during the partition, the partition has affected mostly the north, east, and west part of India. Okay, so the states as we know today, Punjab, Rajasthan, Gujarat on the west side, Bengal on the east side, and if you sort of see the middle provinces like what is today UP, Bihar, etc., most of the people who migrated were essentially the dominant caste. And there's very true on the other side also. The remaining Hindus in, for instance, Sindh in Pakistan, are the Dalit Hindus. So most of the upper caste Hindus migrated into India. Okay? So I think we need to sort of keep this in the back of the mind when we are talking about Islamophobia in India and how cases are framed within the context of Islamophobia in India. Okay. Now, in 1948, the Indian Union Muslim League was registered in India. So, the Indian Union Muslim League is the only political party which is supposed to be based on a Muslim identity at that point of time. This party, interestingly, does not have presence anywhere except Kerala in terms of being able to negotiate power, okay? Now, Kerala and Kashmir are the only two states in India where Muslims are, in terms of numbers and concentrations, are in terms of being able to negotiate power. I mean, Kerala being one of the only states to have had a Muslim chief minister. So, while the other states, for instance, UP, which has a larger Muslim population than Kerala, the population is spread out and mostly is lower caste Muslims. They really don't have the the political negotiating power. Okay, so in that sense, they actually become constituencies of larger political parties in the way the Indian nation itself grows. So in terms of Islamophobia itself, the partition of course was responsible, you know, in one terms of seeing India as Hindustan and being a Hindu country and Pakistan being a Muslim country, but that's just the north. And pockets in the south, like the former erstwhile Hyderabad state. But beyond that, you know, you had constant riots that kept on occurring. These riots could not be, today, I mean, looking back or even referencing to materials like M.J. Akbar's book on riots in India, could not be exactly called Islamophobic riots. But definitely RSS had a role in it and all of that. But Islamophobia, as we see it today, I think we need to sort of date it to the growth, to the transformation of Jansang into BJP, and which is emergency and post-emergency, and the period between 1984 and 1989, when three important decisions were made by the Rajiv Gandhi government at that point of time. One, unlocking the Babri Masjid, which is very crucial in terms of mobilizing anti-Muslim sentiments. Two, the Shabano case, the judgment in the Shabano case, and the parliament passing the Muslim Maintenance Act to overcome the judgment. Three, banning of the satanic verses. India was the first country to ban the satanic verses. So in terms of public imagination, you have Muslims being shown as, I mean, though it was done by people in power, Muslims being shown as this very conservative, fundamentalist kind of grouping. Even there, when you sort of look at the contestations in Kashmir itself, till the 80s, it was not seen as a Muslim problem as much as a Kashmir problem. It was only in the 80s that it started being seen and repeated in the mainstream discourse as a Muslim problem. Then the next phase comes. The next phase is essentially the demolition of the Babri Masjid, and the riots that immediately ensued after Babri Masjid. The Bombay riots are very important in this. And the bomb blast immediately after the Bombay riots. Now, in the bomb blast immediately after the Bombay riots, the way the investigation of the investigating officers and the way the state sort of responded to it was sort of framing, which is a contestable framing the people behind it as the underworld. Even there, you are not talking about a Muslim fundamentalist fringe. We are talking about an underworld fringe. Okay. So between 92 and 9/11, 1992 and 9/11, most of these bans and most of these bomb blasts that have happened in India were almost always attributed to the underworld, and prosecutions and prosecution have always happened in those terms. 9/11 becomes a very important turning point. It's not that there were no blasts before that. 9/11 becomes an extremely important turning point. And without 9/11, I don't think 2002 Gujarat would have happened. So 9/11, you have this global discourse on terror being pinned on Muslim fundamentalism across the world, which sort of gives material for rising Islamophobia in India to sort of pick on it and sort of frame the issue within the context of Islamic fundamentalism. Okay. Now, what I have done through my research is essentially look at people who have been accused of terror, interviewed some of them, interviewed the investigating officers in places, the prosecutors, the defense lawyers, and looked at the paperwork that has gone in through some of these cases. So what I'll do in the process is sort of highlight some of these cases, some of the prominent cases, and I'll sort of end with, how the media has played a huge role, played a huge role in sort of creating this discourse. I'll start off with one case that is live today. live today and very prominent today, which is Madani's case. Okay, see, Abdul Nasser Madani himself is a very interesting phenomenon because the rise of Abdul Nasser Madani was, if you sort of see the videos, quite a lot of them are on YouTube of Madani in the 80s. Madani was a very fiery, charismatic speaker who actually addressed to the Muslim conscience. In the sense that Madani was somebody who was an Islamist, so to speak. You know, there was nothing secular about Madani in that sense. Madani sort of forms his political organization called I mean, a political organization, not in the sense of a political organization that fights elections, but a political organization called ISIS, Islamic Seva Sangh. This was in 1989, and when 1992 the Babri Masjid demolition happened, among the organizations that were banned, because they had to ban RSS, DHP, etc., ISIS was one of the organizations that was banned. So when ISIS was banned, Madani retransforms himself and then forms PDP, which is the political party that he runs today, People's Democratic Party. Now, he was one of the accused in the Coimbatore blast. See, the Coimbatore blast happened in February 1998. And the allegation was that he had connections with Aluma and he was one of the conspirators. And he spent almost a decade in jail. Now, he spent almost a decade in jail before being acquitted. And in this decade, despite, you know, multiple bail pleas at multiple human rights organizations calling for his release, nothing happened. Finally, he was acquitted. When he was acquitted, because there was a threat to his life and perceived threat to his life and all of that, he was given a security detail by the government of Kerala. It was post that he was once again picked up for the Bangalore blast. Okay. Now, the Bangalore blast, he was picked up because a member of PDP called Tadiyan Davide Nasir, who the intelligence bureau calls one of the kingpins of Indian Mujahideen, is supposed to have named Madani as one of the co-conspirators. Okay. The entire evidence on which Madani was picked up rests on three main witnesses. One is Madani's landlord, the house that Madani rented after he was released from Coimbatore jail. It is said that Madani's landlord saw Tadiyan Davide Nasir when he went to collect rent. He saw Tadiyan Davide Nasir at Madani's house. The second witness on which it rests is a plantation worker in Coorg, who says that he saw Madani visiting this plantation in Coorg and having a meeting with Nasir and others. And third, an RSS activist. Okay. Now, interestingly, the landlord says that he was shown a paper in Kannada by Karnataka police and was asked to sign that paper. And he has later filed a complaint with the magistrate in Ernakulam saying that he did not know what he was saying. And he sort of recanted on that. So, now, in terms of Madani's case, again, there has been multiple bail pleas, and each time it has gone up to the Supreme Court, and each time the bail has been rejected, you know. But the important factor, and that's where Madani's case can be linked to the other terror cases, the important factor is, in most of these terror cases, the usual provisions of law under which they are charged would be 124A ITC, sedition, Unlawful Activities Prevention Act, Section 3O, and sometimes Arms Act, not really always, sometimes Arms Act, okay. Now, the problem is most of the lower judiciary are very scared of 124A and UAPA. So scared, I'll just tell you a story that happened to a friend of mine who is not a Muslim, who was picked up because there was a grievance with the, I mean, he had, you know, sort of a hassle with the local MLA. He was picked up by the local police. The CBCID interfered, and he was, you know, the FIR, they had said 124A. And when the bail plea came up before the sessions judge, Papa Mohan, who is actually one of senior advocate from the Madras High Court, had appeared on his behalf. The magistrate would not even listen to the defense argument. 124A, no bail. And there was absolutely no case against them, in the sense that he was distributing a pamphlet saying how can we, on Republic Day, saying how can we celebrate our republic when Adivasis and Chhattisgarh are being killed. Okay? And it went to the High Court. Of course, the High Court granted bail. So this is Islamophobia has sort of created this fear amongst the lower judiciary, where the lower judiciary, especially you know when it is special cells of the police like the ATS, SIT, or CBCID, which is involved in the investigation, is very scared to sort of grant any relief. Grant any relief or even follow procedure, you know. Now, Asamgarh is another very interesting story because I had all Asamgarh is the place after the Bhatla House encounter. Asamgarh was a place that was linked as, you know, the hub of terror recruitment across India. Now, one of the leaders, one of the alleged kingpins of Indian Mujahideen, this guy called Abu Bashir, it's a guy who doesn't know. I mean, this guy is, I mean, if you meet him, he's completely learning challenged. You know, he doesn't know, apart from the Quran by rote, he doesn't know anything. But that apart, there was this whole spree where police were picking up people, including PUCL activists, non-Muslim PUCL activists, who were saying that there is no terror up in Asamgarh, okay? Police were picking these people up. In most cases, they would pick them up. They would not file an FIR. These boys would not be produced before a magistrate till civil society organizations sort of raise a UN cry about these boys going missing, and then they would be produced, and then they would be linked to some case or the other. Now that has sort of stopped because the civil society has been closely watching Asamgarh. Okay. The other excellent example would be the Makkah Masjid blast. In Hyderabad, when the Makkah Masjid blast happened, immediately after the Makkah Masjid blast happened, the police went on a rampage, picked up more than 80 Muslim boys from old Hyderabad, saying that there was the Laskar-e Toiba link in the whole blast. And these boys, nobody knew where they were, whether they had been arrested at all, okay? The late K. Balgopal, the Human Rights Forum coordinator, he and a couple of other human rights workers, they sort of tried tracing these boys, could not find them, put pressure, filed a habeas corpus petition in the High Court, Andhra Pradesh High Court. When the habeas corpus petition was filed, then an FIR was lodged. And these people were, produced before the magistrate. Now, all of this, and by then, and this is all happening at the pre-trial stage, okay? And the police were, the evidences were already being published in newspapers, etc. And suddenly, Eamon Karkare sort of discovers this whole RSS link in Malegaon. And with Asimananda Saras, you sort of there is also think there's also a pointer to Mecca Masjid also being done by these same outfits. And by then, Balagopal had filed a writ petition in the High Court, and then the High Court called for the records, the police records. And the funniest thing was, like I said, this was pre-trial. The charge sheet had not been filed. The funniest thing was these boys were picked up for having watched a film, I forget the name of the film, a film in a burial ground. Yeah, the film was Hey Ram in the Name of Gandhi. Now, the whole thing being that when the whole thing, how this picking up and, The other important actor in this whole drama, I should mention, is the Delhi Police Special Cell, who have been sort of framing these charges. And what happens each time, you have this long protracted trials. Here, the Sarojini Nagar blast is another example. You have this long protracted trials. people get acquitted at the end of the trial. Madani is the best example for it, but there are multiple examples like that. Sarojini Nagar blast case is one such case. Four people were acquitted after some 8 years in jail. They were picked up when they were 21 or so. They get released when they were 29. The moment they were released, they were picked up by the anti-terrorist squad of Rajasthan for the Jaipur blast. So it's sort of a continuing circle. And on top of it, what happens is once you're branded, whether you're acquitted or not, once you're branded as a terrorist, you're always within the police radar. One, you're within the police radar, and two, you become unemployable. So in the Indian context, what happens is, yeah, the other story I need to tell is about SIMI. Now, the SIMI is one organization that was banned under the Unlawful Activities Prevention Act. And from 2002, I mean, they were banned in 2002. They were banned after the Gujarat the Gujarat pogrom. Now, SIMI has been early till 2006. It was always SIMI, you know, whenever a blast happened, the fingers would be pointed at SIMI. Now, SIMI had been trying to fight the ban in courts each time the ban happened. So, under the UAPA, a special tribunal has to be set up every time a ban is notified under the UAPA. The tribunal has to be headed by a judge, a sitting judge of the High Court. And the tribunal sort of looks at all the evidence that is there, and the tribunal comes to its findings and says whether the organization needs to be banned or not. And this, the life of the ban is for 2 years, okay? Now, each time SIMI has been banned, by the time the tribunal ends, the ban will be renewed, and then there will be a new tribunal. So I think the third tribunal sort of found that there was no evidence against SIMI. The moment they said, the judge said that there was no evidence against SIMI, the union government passed an ordinance again under UAPA, notifying SIMI as an unlawful agency. Now, the secretary of SIMI, when it was banned, when it was prescribed, Falahi, he said that he doesn't believe in the judicial system anymore and he doesn't want to sort of challenge the ban anymore. But beyond that, what happened was in 2006, when Bhatla House encounter happened and people started racing, one was Geeta Puthas, giving SIMI a clean chit. And after the Bhatla House encounter, organizations like Jamia Teacher Solidarity Association, PUCL, and journalists also coming out with this whole story about how SIMI could be connected or not connected. The government suddenly finds it difficult to have material to sort of corroborate their claims that these activities are done by SIMI. And that is how Indian Mujahideen is born. That is a time frame within Indian Mujahideen is born. And with Indian Mujahideen being born also, outside people in prison, I mean, no author, I mean, there have been multiple books that have been written about, books and articles that have been written by Indian Mujahideen, multiple people who have been researching about it. But nobody has found these cells outside the realms of what the government has been putting out. Okay? Now, interestingly, this information is sort of traced back to the Intelligence Bureau. Now, with the Intelligence Bureau itself, the Intelligence Bureau itself is a pre-colonial agency. And with the Intelligence Bureau itself, the Intelligence Bureau, there is actually a writ petition pending in the Bangalore High Court asking the simple question is, where the Intelligence Bureau gets its authority from, because it is not established under any statute that is existing, pre-colonial or post-colonial, and so therefore they don't answer to anybody. No, so there is nobody has any clue about where the where the intelligence comes from, and there is absolutely no accountability to it. Okay, Okay, let us now assume that in terms of national security, etc., you need to have something like that. Even given that assumption, there's another problem that is there with our criminal justice administration, why these people actually end up rotting in jail for a long time. I take the example of Dr. Hani's case. Dr. Hani, if you remember, was this medical doctor who was picked up in Australia immediately after the Glasgow blast or his cousin was supposed to be one of the suicide bombers in the Glasgow airport blast case, and he was picked up, and he was questioned by the Australian authorities. What was interesting was through that whole week where he was held in custody, almost all the mainstream Indian newspapers and television media, the screaming headlines was Indian doctor, a terrorist, you know, they had all labeled him a terrorist. Some of the Australian human rights groups got together, got the transcripts of the interrogation and found it to be completely Islamophobic. They were really stupid questions that were asked, and there was nothing in that which would indict them, okay? So when the transcripts got out, the very same newspapers which were calling him a terrorist published the transcript. It sort of turned into a national spectacle about how an Indian was being harassed in a foreign country. I mean, that story, that is one of the stories that ended well in the sense that he got compensated and got an apology from the government of Australia. But the Indian government, be it Mecca Masjid, be it Coimbatore Blast, the Indian government has never, I mean, the most basic thing, you know, prosecuting the people for building false cases. None of the state governments, I mean, it's not just the central government, none of the state governments in this whole discourse of Islamophobia, none of the state governments or the union government has even gone on record admitting their fault in fabricating false charges, even when these people have been acquitted or even when there has been a transformational shift in the investigation. You know, Mecca Masjid or Ajmer or the Ajmer blast are the best examples for this. Now coming to the last segment. The role of the media. Now one way that this whole drama has played out in the last 20 years, the span of last 20 years, last two decades, is how the media has been very, very strategically used by investigating authorities to plan stories on terrorism. I mean, the best example would be this very famous journalist called Praveen Swamy. Okay, when the Issajan encounter happened, the day the Issajan encounter happened, on the front page of the Hindu was Praveen Swamy's story detailing how Issajan met Pranesh Pillai, Pranesh Pillai alias Javed, and how they sort of, you know, orchestrated the whole plan to assassinate Modi, and how they were on the way, and you know, it was, the whole story was there in detail. Okay, the same Praveen Swamy, you know, and then he sort of keeps carrying these stories till questions are raised about the legitimacy of the encounter. Just 3 days back, the same Praveen Swamy says that encounters are a curse for the Republic, mentioning Issajan. So we have this, and it's not just Praveen Swamy. Praveen Swamy is just one example. We have embedded journalists to whom it would be defamatory for me to say IB, but in all likelihood it has to be IB, to whom sources within the establishment give out what they call evidence, whether they have it or not, and then these narratives come out in the mainstream newspapers, and these narratives are propagated further. Okay, the most recent example is this book called The Indian Mujahideen, The Enemy Within. It was written by the author's name, I forget, And, you know, the Home Minister, the then Home Minister, P. Chidambaram himself was inaugurating the book. So when the book came under sharp criticism, P. Chidambaram said it was shoddily researched. So you have this entire setup, which is, I'm not building a conspiracy theory. Rather, what I'm saying is you have an establishment in place which sort of looks, and one needs to understand that there is no homogeneous Muslim community in India. I mean, within Kerala itself, let us take, or Tamil Nadu itself, there would be at least four or five different communities. Kerala has Maplas, you have the Rauters, you have the Patanis, you have the, you know, Tamil Nadu has the Labayas. So you have different kinds of Muslim communities within a state itself. And their rituals, their devotional basis, their faith, all of this differs. So this whole process is essentially about creating this myth of a homogenized Muslim community. And this myth sort of feeds into creating this whole hysteria of Islamophobia. Now, this hysteria works at one level where the investigating agencies, for them to pick up anybody at their will. The judiciary is very scared to sort of intervene or follow procedure because the hysteria is already there and these biases are already running through them. And finally, the mainstream society has no option but to buy into this hysteria. Now, this hysteria sort of goes unchallenged outside fringe human rights groups, etc. That is the core of my research project. As a fantastic example of how the judiciary sort of flames the whole Islamophobic discourse is this whole concept called love jihad. Okay, and this whole story about love jihad, in fact, I met the police officer who invented the story, not the police officer, the constable, who is part of the Sun. This whole story starts with the case, with the habeas corpus petition that was filed in the Kerala High Court, where two girls eloped with two Muslim boys. Policeman who was since it was a habeas corpus thing, the policeman who accompanied, who found these girls and accompanied them to court, apparently made a statement saying this part of a larger this thing. And Justice Shankaran was hearing the habeas corpus petition. So Justice Shankaran says, gives an order saying that the Kerala police should investigate love jihad. Okay, that's how the whole thing starts. Kerala media goes overboard. You know, they sort of say love jihad is a huge complex network where Muslim youth are being paid X amount of money every month, given cars and bikes to go seduce girls and, you know, marry them and convert them into Islam and all of that. One of the girls, fortunately or unfortunately, was related also to the then DGP of Kerala, Jacob Punas. So he, the intelligence chief of the Kerala intelligence chief at that point of time, the IG, was somebody called Padma Kumar. So Padma Kumar, I had interviewed Padma Kumar later, and Padma Kumar himself says that they actually filed, and I've also seen the affidavit that they filed in the High Court. Police said there is no such thing as love jihad, and usually intelligence reports are always fake. They are never direct. You know, they never say this happens or this doesn't happen. In this case, they were like, Punas had directed Padma Kumar to be as blunt as possible. Okay, and the affidavit clearly says that there is no such thing as love jihad. Justice Shankaran is not convinced. Justice Shankaran says the police has not done its work properly and they have to reinvestigate the whole matter. And by then, this had sort of gone very messy for the judiciary also. And then we had organized the protest, not the protest, it was more like a press conference in Delhi with eminent Kerala figures like Poet K. Sachidanandan, A.K. Ramakrishnan, and then John Dayal Extra, and, you know, he had issued a statement, and, you know, there were protests that were happening, and this was getting even more embarrassing for the judiciary, and then the Trinity Justice of Kerala High Court sort of removed Justice Shankaran from the case and put another judge on his behalf, and, you know, then he disposed of the matter. Because it was just a habeas corpus petition. So the whole story of Love Jihad starts there, and once the story has started off there, despite the fact that it has been, on record, it has been sort of dismissed as not being factually true. Every time there is a case of a Muslim girl, and it has now sort of spread across India, and every time there's a case of a Muslim girl, a non-Muslim girl marrying or eloping with a Muslim boy, Love Jihad is involved. So, in fact, there's a very interesting case that sort of came up with me personally. In fact, this is a friend. This couple, both of them are journalists working with the mainstream media organization in Kerala. And they're not even, they were not even thinking of marriage, you know. They were a couple, they were together. I mean, they had not decided whether they wanted to get married or split or any of these things. Now, this girl happens to be from a Christian family. This girl happens to be from an Nair family. And the girl's family, when she had gone on a holiday, had sort of locked her up. So some of her friends had to sort of go to the house and literally abduct her and get her back to Trivandrum. And the first thing they did was they sort of took her to the DGP, and Puno sort of advised them to file a complaint in the local police station where the girl was living, saying that her family had kept her against her wish. In the meantime, the girl's family, the girl's uncle went to the, and the boy's family had no clue of what was happening. The girl's uncle went to the boy's father, who was around 70 plus, and threatened him, saying that, you know, this is Love Jihad, and we'll make sure that your family is dragged through mud for the whole thing. So this whole Love Jihad, this is even recently, just I think a couple of days back, something that happened in UP. Two girls eloping with two Muslim boys. Immediately, you know, you invoke Love Jihad, despite the fact that, you know, both judiciary and the police have sort of said Love Jihad does not exist. Yeah, that's the other thing I wanted to say.